All right, here's what you need to know about today. China is reminding Japan about what happened after they attacked Pearl Harbor. Those are strong words. That's a strong statement. We're going to talk to two superstars, Victor Gao from China and Pascal Lota from Japan, about this. This could be good. Crazy violence and bombings and fires and killings in Mexico. Mexico. I'm going to tell you who actually caused this mess. Here's a clue, by the way. It's not Mexico. And the Huckabee interview being heard around the world. That's outraged some of the countries in the Middle East, among others. Mr. Tucker's viewpoint, and mine, by the way, right here on The Sanchez Effect. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. So good to see you again. We have to talk about Mexico. Wow. Because what's happening there is kind of crazy, no? Let's start with these scenes. This is in Guadalajara. Take a look. Look at this panic. Just, by the way, this is like, look at the airport. These are scenes from the airport right there in Guadalajara, repeated in different parts of Mexico as residents and tourists alike panicked as they heard that there was some fighting in the streets. I mean, look at this. I've been to this airport. I've been to Guadalajara covering stories in Mexico. Can you imagine these people are there going to Mexico and they're already freaked out because they're getting ready to get on a plane and they're at the airport. And many of these people are tourists, by the way, from the United States. Millions of Americans go to Mexico for peace, quiet, and relaxation. Oops, not this time, I guess. All right, now, these scenes of violence, and look at this. Look at this. This is fires, blockages around the country of roads. Sources inside Mexico are saying that even in the capital city, people are afraid to go outside. I talked to some of my sources in Mexico last night. That's what they were telling me, as cartel members used cars and trucks to block major roads and people trying to get out of the cities. It paralyzed. Parts of the city were just paralyzed because people couldn't get in and out. So here's the question, right? What is causing this? This guy's arrest. I'm going to show him to you. There he is. See that? That's Nemesio Oseguera. He's known as El Mincho. He's the head of the Jalisco cartel, powerful organization with tons of guns, tons of money. And the U.S. pressured the Mexican government to kill El Mencho, thinking that somehow that would stop the drug trafficking. History says it will not. Now, I want to hear something. I want you to hear something. Because when I heard this, I thought to myself, come on. Sounds naive. This is how a U.S. State Department official characterizes the situation in Mexico. For him, it's all about good guys and bad guys.
I've just been informed the Mexican security forces have killed El Mencho, one of the bloodiest and most ruthless drug kingpins. This is a great development for Mexico, the U.S., Latin America, and the world. The good guys are stronger than the bad guys.
Yeah, he says it's about the good guys being stronger than the bad guys. But then he drops a clue as to how little he actually knows or maybe even cares about Mexico, which is very common in the United States. Oh, yeah, that little country down there. He tries to translate into Spanish, and he completely butchers it. He says, los buenos somos más que los malos. The good guys are more than the bad guys. More what? Because it's not a good translation. Look, I got to tell you something. And this is kind of important to me, so I'll share it with you. I've spent a lot of decades in journalism covering this part of the world. I've been to Guadalajara. I know the airport. Like I mentioned, I covered the cartels in Mexico as well. And you know what I've come to know? I've come to know that this story is not as simple as good guys and bad guys, right? Let me start with this here. How is it possible? Ask yourself this question. How is it possible that Mexico can become such a dangerous and violent place riddled with cartels when Mexicans themselves generally don't do drugs, right? And they're not allowed to buy guns and ammunition. So how does this happen, right? Well, the answer to this question is its neighbor, the United States. Yeah. The United States is where the drugs are sold and used. And the United States is where the funding and the weaponry for the cartels originates. I'm going to take you through this story so you can better understand it. The Jalisco cartel, like other drug traffickers in Mexico, are equipped by U.S. gun manufacturers. According to a 60 Minutes investigation, 90% of its weapons are traced back to the United States, where the government and the courts in places like Texas just look the other way so that gun manufacturers can make hundreds of millions of dollars on gun sales that meticulously sneak across the border and into the hands of these drug traffickers. In other words, Mexico makes laws to ensure that drug traffickers and others don't have guns in their country. The U.S. finds a way to skirt those laws. The problem is so bad, Mexico is now suing the United States and its weapons manufacturers for allowing this to happen. Mexican authorities have told me themselves they feel helpless. When I went there, I talked to local police officers, and I saw it for myself while I was investigating these cartels, and I saw what they have. A lot of these guys now have high-powered military-grade weapons from the U.S. They've got AR-15s, AK-47-style semi-automatic rifles, 50-caliber sniper rifles, grenade launchers. Even the police there told me that they're outgunned. As many as 500,000 firearms are flowing into Mexico from the United States. They even given it a name. They call it the River of Iron. And then there's this question, right? The question of who buys, sells, and consumes the drugs. It's not Mexicans. Consumption in Mexico of opioids like fentanyl is tiny, minuscule, compared to the consumption in the United States, where as many as 8 million people consume opioids or overuse opioids. And we're 100,000, Mr. Trump said this, he's right about this, 100,000 people a year are dying from overdoses in the United States. So yes, Mexico has a cartel problem, but its origins are rooted in CIA missions in Central America, rooted in the greedy actions of arms dealers and manufacturers who sell or smuggle the traffickers their weapons. And it's rooted in the loyal base of U.S. consumers that are simply in the United States arrested, then rearrested, then jailed, then rejailed over and over again, but seldom treated for their addiction. So what are the roots of Mexico's drug problem? Follow the money. All right, let's talk about the Huckabee interview. It's created big problems for Israel and for the United States. May actually end up helping Iran in some indirect way, because thanks to Tucker Carlson's impressive and cogent questioning of U.S. Ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee, it's about time. Countries all over the Middle East are furious right now with him and the U.S. and Israel. So here, let's start with this. This is what Huckabee said about Israel's claim to all of the lands that it might eventually just want to take.
What land are you talking about? Because I just read Genesis 15, as I have many times. Mm-hmm. And that land, I think it says, from the Nile to the Euphrates, which is, once again, basically the entire Middle East. So God gave that land to his people, the Jews, or he didn't. You're saying he did. What does that mean? Does Israel have the right to that land? Because you're appealing to Genesis.
Yeah.
You're saying that's the original deed.
It would be fine if they took it all.
Oh, my God. It would be fine if they took it all? Wow. If Israel credits its claim on the biblical verse that says the Euphrates to the Nile, well, there it is. We made a map for you so you can see it. Look at the land between the Euphrates and the Nile. There it is. Look at all those countries, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, parts of Iraq, Egypt, Saudi Arabia. Is that what Huckabee is implying? Is greater Israel? This is not sitting well with leaders around the Middle East who came together because of Huckabee to sign this letter. Let me show it to you. Countries in the region say that they're outraged by Huckabee's nonchalant and careless comments, and they came together to sign this decree saying so. This letter was signed, look at it, dangerous and inflammatory remarks, they say, right? Signed by Saudi Arabia, Gulf states, Jordan, Egypt, among other, all of them got together. And these are countries, some of them don't even like each other. But even during the interview, Huckabee seemed to double down, implying that Israel was presently at war with these countries.
I keep hearing Israel's fighting a seven-front war right now. What are those seven fronts?
Well, you got Lebanon. You have Egypt.
Egypt.
Now, Egypt is not an active war, but you have the Muslim Brotherhood within Egypt. You've got the Muslim Brotherhood in Jordan. You've got Syria.
Wait, they're fighting a war with Jordan?
With the Muslim Brotherhood that is in Jordan, not directly with Jordan, not the government of Jordan.
But are they...
You've got Hezbollah. You've got...
In Lebanon.
Houthis.
In Yemen.
You have Hamas in Gaza. You have the threats that come from Iran. And how many is that?
That's seven.
That's seven.
So if you've got a group of people in a country, then you're at war with that country? What? Huckabee's appearance with Carlson revealed him as a shill, really, right? I know Mike Huckabee. I like Mike Huckabee. I got to know him. We used to talk all the time when we were in New York together, right? When I worked at CNN. Unlike most ambassadors, though, sent by their countries to represent their interests, he's not, right? He's basically representing Israel's interests while serving the United States. He comes across as a guy who works for Israel. I mean, it was tough to watch. This guy's a complete sellout. Truth be told, who also seemed desperate for a war with Iran. Desperate, without seeming to care about what impact it would have on Iran or on American soldiers or Americans' pocketbooks. It's like he works for Israel to try and start a war with Iran. Speaking of Iran, here's what I said on my podcast when Tucker was detained in Israel, when I revealed that I, too, had been detained, but I was detained in Iran, not Israel. I feel like I was safer in those conditions than I would have been in his condition. I would be more apt to think that if I'm being held by Iranians, I will likely have a positive outcome. Whereas if I'm being held by Israelis, I'm not sure I would have a positive outcome. Vis-a-vis, what I'm saying is Tucker was in a worse situation, I think, than I was. Now think about that. They're supposed to be our allies, but here's why, and follow my thinking here. If I had a problem with the Iranians, I have confidence that the United States government, my government, and I am a citizen of the United States, would come to my defense. And they would hold the Iranian government accountable. Ask me if I think I could say that about the Israeli government. No, I don't think they would. As a matter of fact, I think if the Israeli government did something to me, or had they done something to Tucker, I think my government would have covered for him. I think that's just the way it is. Now I want you to listen to Tucker. I watched his whole thing the other night while I was chatting with him, but here's the prelude that he gives, right, during his toss, or before his interview, right? He's tossing to the interview with Huckabee, and he starts talking about the situation right now, and he basically says the very same thing that I said.
We're looking at the reality, which is if you're an American in Israel, you can be certain that your government will take the side of the Israeli government and not your side. And really, is that so different from the experience of Americans in the United States? Can you be sure that your government will take your side over the Israeli government? No, of course not. They will always take the Israeli government's side over yours. And that's the core problem.
I want to take you now to another part of the world. Something happened recently at the Munich Security Council that certainly got my attention. I keep a notepad with all the things I see that I want to talk about, and sometimes I have to push this one back a little bit, which we did, but it's still important. When I heard this, I saw China was issuing a stark warning to Japan, and it said to Japan in no uncertain terms that it would be a huge mistake to continue going down this road of increased militarization. In fact, it even made the comparison of Pearl Harbor by reminding Japan of what happened after the last time that it over-militarized and it attacked Hawaii.
The current Japanese prime minister publicly claimed that any contingency in the Taiwan Strait would constitute a so-called survival-threatening situation for Japan, forcing it to exercise collective self-defense. The lessons of history are not far away and must be closely examined. Back then, Japan launched its aggression against China and attacked Pearl Harbor under the same pretext of a so-called survival-threatening situation. If Japan refuses to repent, it will inevitably repeat the same mistakes. This is the law of history. The kind-hearted people should be vigilant. The Japanese people should not allow themselves to be coerced and blinded by far-right forces that even want to revive militarism. All peace-loving countries should send a warning to Japan. If it tries to go back on that path, it will bring about its own destruction. And if it gambles once more, it will only be defeated more quickly and suffer a harsher loss.
I wanted to drill down on this. So joining us now to talk about this are two of the smartest people that I know who have appeared here on this show before. Victor Gao and I got to know each other in China while I was covering the Shanghai summit. Really smart guy, good guy. He's an expert on China's rise economically because he was a part of it. He advised the president at the time, and he's a former investment banker with Morgan Stanley. Also joining us from Japan is none other than Pascal Lotta. He is a Swiss academic, professor of neutrality studies, who hosts a very, very good and popular podcast, which I happen to be a fan of. It's called Neutrality Studies. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Hello.
Listen, there's some breaking news that we have to start with. A little bit off topic, but maybe not so much. Reuters has just reported, and what they're reporting is that Iran is very close to a deal with China to purchase anti-ship cruise missiles. This, of course, is just as the United States is getting ready to deploy a vast naval force, or already has, to the Iranian coast ahead of a possible attack on Iran. It's a little off topic, but Victor, would you comment on this for us? Because we're talking about Chinese, they're called CM-302 missiles, described as supersonic missiles. They have a range of about 300,000 kilometers. They're designed to evade shipborne defenses by, they go really low down to almost the surface of the water and then can rise again. Did I say something? 300, yes, kilometers. Victor, what do you make of this? What should we think of this? What does it say?
Thank you very much. Both China and Iran are two fully independent countries with their sovereignty. And there is no international law which prohibits China and Iran to engage with each other in commercial transactions. And China happens to produce some of the most sophisticated missiles of all kinds. And it's absolutely right for China and Iran to size up each other and engage in whatever economic and commercial transactions they desire to do that, including involving such military missiles. And yeah. I think the whole world should be put on notice that both China and Iran will have full sovereign right to do such commercial transactions with each other, and no country should pretend to be surprised.
But given the timing of what's going on right now, those sound a little bit like fighting words. Pascal, you want to take this?
I mean, to me, this sounds very much like China is sending a very, very clear message, just that if there will be a war, it will certainly be a war, a missile war, right? The way that we've seen it in June last year during the 12-day war, that was not fought with boots on the ground. It was not fought with ships on the sea. It was fought with the missiles that were flying over these other countries. This time, if the United States intervenes, of course, there are going to be missiles on the sea, but there are going to be ships on the sea, but those ships are going to be just as vulnerable to missiles. And China just made it very clear that if the missile war happens, and if it takes quite a bit of time, you know, like the Ukraine war, if it's not done within a couple of weeks, then Chinese missiles will be ready to be supplied. So it's not just the Iranian capacity to produce missiles, it's also the capacity of China to supply them. And, you know, this will take time. Operating these missiles will take time, but the signal, the political signal is very clear.
Yeah, so that's the point, Victor. I mean, is China using this moment on the brink of what could be an attack on Iran by the United States to send a message to the United States with this announcement? right now? I mean, if they'd said this a year ago, nobody would have even paid attention, but it matters now, no?
Well, it is clear to everyone in the world in decency that Iran is not threatening the United States with war or military confrontation. It is just the opposite. The United States is threatening war against Iran, coupled with Israel. Therefore, let's really clarify who is at fault, who is not at fault. Iran is not threatening war against the United States. It's the United States threatening war against Iran. So how can you say, now that Iran is being threatened with war and military confrontation by the United States, therefore you should not export missiles to Iran? It's just the opposite. The United States should stop threatening Iran with war and engage with Iran in peace, rather than in such military jingoism.
Speaking of the United States, they're certainly very much involved militaristically with Japan of late. And there seems to be this charge that we heard at the Munich summit just a little while ago that Japan seems to be over-militarizing itself, and China is sending them this message that you heard just a little while ago in no uncertain terms. Does China have a point, Pascal, when it makes that that warning to Japan?
Yes, it does. I mean, China clearly has very, very bad memories of Japan, and we must never forget all of the crimes that were committed in China, mainland China, in the north, the millions of people who died during the 15-year war, 1931 to 1945. And we must not underestimate just the sheer emotions that any form of Japanese militarism invokes in China. On the other hand, when we try to understand what recently happened, we also must keep in mind that what Prime Minister Takaichi said was clearly a breach of protocol. It was clearly something that even Mr. Abe before her, the long-serving right-wing prime minister, never actually said. And she did so, but she did in the context of being questioned by the opposition party. I still interpret it as a slip of the tongue, not that she didn't think so, she does, but that she said so was clearly unwise, but it kind of unleashed a box of Pandora on, especially like, because in China, this cannot be interpreted in any other way.
Are you convinced, Victor, that the Japanese are, in fact, militarizing to a dangerous or threatening level?
Let me really go to the jugular of this issue. I think what Prime Minister Takaichi did and said in recent weeks and months is tantamount to Japan's attempt to deny the ironclad verdict of Japan's unconditional surrender to China and other allied countries, including the United States and the former Soviet Union and the United Kingdom, because Japan unconditionally surrendered. And there are terms for Japan never to constitute another military threat against China. Otherwise, they will be in breach of their unconditional surrender terms, and China, being a victor nation, has the absolute full right to strike at Japan to prevent the rise of Japanese militarism or neo-Japanese fascism, period. That's carved in the United Nations Charter. If you read the enemy state clause, it specifically clarifies China's right to use unilateral military might against Japan to prevent Japan from constituting another military threat against China, especially if Japan dares to arm itself with nuclear weapons. I've declared on many occasions, the moment Japan possesses nuclear weapon will be the moment of the annihilation of Japan as a state, period. No politician, including Prime Minister Takaichi, should indulge in fantasy that they could be allowed to militarily arm itself to constitute another threat or to threaten war against China, which is a victor nation, and Japan is the unconditionally surrendering country back in 1945. We should keep this in historical perspective, and mankind as a whole should unite to deny Japan any chance of remilitarization and constituting another militaristic or fascist threat to China. China lost 35 million of our countrymen at the hands of the Japanese militarists. Should anyone really expect that China should allow the re-rise of Japanese militarism and neo-Japanese fascism? No way. Prime Minister Takashiki, wake up from your fantasy. You should never be allowed to rearm yourself to constitute another threat to China or to Russia or to Korea, for example, or to the United States, because we all need to remember Pearl Harbor. Never forget Pearl Harbor.
Victor, those are really strong words. I just want to make sure I heard you clearly, because I think what you just said will likely make news. You're saying China has the preemptive right to strike Japan, and not only has the right to do so, but will do so if it feels that Japan is over-militarizing. Is that what you say?
Absolutely. That's authorized in the United Nations Charter regarding the enemy state clause. It is specifically stipulated that the enemy state, which includes Japan, if they dare to rearm itself to constitute a military threat against a victor nation, which includes China, then the victor nation has the right to use preemptive military might to prevent that remilitarization or neo-Japanese fascism from raising its dangerous head. It's carved in stone. It's part of the international order that we are living in through. So no one in the world should pretend that they are ignorant of this enemy state clause contained very secretly in the United Nations Charter.
Just one final question so people can understand what you're saying. Is the threshold for a preemptive strike the determination that Japan has some kind of nuclear weaponry capability or something shy of that?
Well, as I mentioned, the moment Japan possesses the nuclear weapon will be the moment of the annihilation of Japan as a state, period. Now, before then, if Japan tried to arm itself with other weapons of mass destruction and to constitute a military threat or to threaten to use war against China, these all may be considered as sufficient for triggering the enemy state clause in the United Nations Charter. Therefore, I just hope Prime Minister Takaichi will not really pretend to be ignorant of the enemy state clause in the United Nations Charter, and she should not be allowed to turn every inch of the land in Japan into a battleground and push the 120 million Japanese people into the abyss of war again. Japan suffered hugely at the hands of the Japanese fascism before they unconditionally surrendered in 1945. They should never be allowed to be pushed again into the abyss of war or threat of war or aggression against China.
Pascal, what do you make of that? And what do you think the prime minister will do?
I think I must just disagree with the language before. We must understand, like, there's a big difference between fascist militarism on the one hand and a security dilemma on the other hand. And language that just was used will only lead to one thing, which is that the Japanese will feel more threatened. As I said in the beginning, we must not forget the 35 million, as you correctly said, dead during the Second World War. But if anyone currently says Japan will be annihilated with nuclear weapons, all this will do is push Japan to think about how to arm itself more. So what is needed at the moment is really words of reassurance and understanding in order not to land in a security dilemma. So there are moments when countries go full-blown fascist and just want to conquer. There are moments when countries land in mutual fear of each other. And Japan is not just afraid of China. Japan is also very much afraid of the nukes of North Korea. Japan so far does not seek nuclear weapons. It seeks the ability to deter those. That in and of itself is not so much of a wise thing to do, because deterrence leaves out the ability to have friends, right? Friendship is the best defense against any form of attacks. Yeah. So what we need to avoid at this point is really where both sides perceive each other as a mortal enemy. And words of will be destroyed, will be annihilated, and so on, do not help in de-escalating a situation.
So what I hear you saying is that you think Victor should be less threatening, that he may have a point, but he shouldn't use such bombastic language. Do you take the point, Victor, or do you disagree? Are you threatening?
Absolutely not. There is only one person and one country which are threatening. That is Prime Minister Takeuchi of Japan and the Japanese government, which want to go deeper and deeper into remilitarization, which may be considered as the remilitarization and the new Japanese fascism. And allow me to make this point again. Japan should never be allowed to constitute another military threat against China. And the moment they constitute a threat or to threaten to use war against China will trigger the enemy state clause in the United Nations Charter, enabling China to take unilateral military action to prevent the rearmament of Japan and the reappearance of Japanese fascism in Japan. And allow me to mention, this is not a threat. This is carved in stone. The moment Japan possesses nuclear weapons will be the annihilation of Japan as a state, period.
Yeah.
Prime Minister Takeuchi, I hope you will listen to me.
Oh, I'm sure she will. Do you get a sense, Pascal, that China has for too long felt like a country that the West has ill-treated historically, and even you could, I guess, make the argument more recently? And within the last year, since I've been following the story, and both of you are a lot more connected and a lot smarter than I am when it comes to this, but I have gotten a sense, as a journalist, as an outsider, that China is kind of asserting itself with the kind of language that we just heard from Victor more than they ever had in the past. Do you see this too, Pascal?
I had a little bit of difficulties to understand the question, but you know, one thing I need to add at this point is just also that the Japan's current approach to its military strategy also has just as much to do with the United States as it has with China, because the United States, on the one hand, is putting a lot of pressure on Japan to remilitarize. Mm. On the other hand, it also is proving to be a very unreliable partner. And this was already perceived during the first Trump administration, and it is perceived so even more now. So what the Japanese are thinking about right now is how to guarantee their national security, perceiving that there are threats from North Korea and from China, and potentially even South Korea. I mean, depending on how the relationship goes. At the moment, it's a little bit better, but there were quite bad times as well. And the countries do not take decisions based upon like a bird's eye perspective of the next 50, 60, 70 years. They take decisions based upon how they perceive threats at the moment. And the threat for Japan at the moment is abandonment by the United States and assertive action by China, North Korea, on the other hand. And so they are now trying to develop more capabilities locally. They do not try to develop nuclear weapons. The three nuclear nodes are still carved in stone as far as we go now. So I do, and Japan has constrained its military for the last 75 years very much. So I do not see a fundamental change in that approach, but in the acquisition of weapons and in its military doctrine of what can be striked at.
Can you hear me now? Can you hear me, Pascal?
Yes.
Okay. There's a famous quote I think both of you are probably familiar with. I think it's a fascinating quote. It says something like this: being the friend of the United States is dangerous. Pardon me. Being the enemy of the United States is dangerous. Being a friend to the United States is fatal. Could China be, pardon me, could Japan be falling into the trap of allowing the United States to egg it on almost in a wrong direction, which is what is causing this ire from the Chinese? Pascal, I'll let you attack that first, since you brought this up just a little while ago.
Japan, the U.S.-Japan alliance is to Japan what NATO is to the Europeans. It's the backbone of all of their security thinking. Yeah. And while they clearly want to maintain that, they are aware of the danger of entrapment and being pushed into something that they don't want. And let me say so, like, you know, dying for Taipei is not a popular slogan among the population of Japan, whatever the current prime minister is saying. The problem that we have now is that because she said that and there was a big reaction from China, there's actually a good part of the Japanese population who now thinks, oh, we need to stand up to China. You know, we end up in this kind kind of stupid, who has the stronger words kind of situation, which is really what I think the Japanese government should do everything it can to get out of, because these words unfortunately started it.
Yeah, it's about lowering the heat. Hey, I'm wondering, Victor, who are these far-right forces in Japan? I keep hearing Chinese officials refer to. Who are these far-right forces that you're referring to?
Well, these key people keep going to the so-called Yasukuni Shrine, the center of Japan, Tokyo, to pay respect to those war criminals hanged by the Far Eastern Military Tribunal after Japan unconditionally surrendered. They want to continue to embrace the spirits and the ghosts of the Japanese fascists. They want to resurrect their militarism to constitute a threat to China and other countries. This is what we call the remnants of the Japanese fascism. They do exist, including, most likely, Prime Minister Takaichi. She wants to visit Yasukuni Shrine again. She visited it again and again throughout her political career. We want to make it clear, the moment she visits Yasukuni Shrine again, in her capacity as the sitting Prime Minister of Japan, she will forever destroy any remaining goodwill between China and Japan. She will carve herself into a new Japanese fascism. So we want to give this warning to Japanese politicians and the Japanese government that it is time for you to sever any association with Japanese fascism, and you should never allow the rise of Japanese fascism again. We do not want to see any iota of Japanese fascism occurring anywhere in Japan, especially among the ranks of the Japanese high-ranking officials, including Prime Minister Takaichi.
Let's talk about the people. I just spent a week in Iran, and I went there thinking that the Iranian people, as a Westerner, as an American, I've always been told the Iranian people are dangerous, religious fanatics, hateful, can't stand the West, can't stand Americans. And yet when I got there, I found just the opposite. They're wonderful, kind, pleasant people who probably know more about America than many Americans do and do not hate Americans. When I hung out with Victor in China, I also had a sense that there was a certain antagonism at the time between the United States and China. And I got a sense from the Chinese people, they have nothing against Americans in general. I asked that question to you, Pascal, because I'm thinking, if I were to go to Japan tomorrow and I talked to the people and stopped in the streets and did man on the street interviews, would I get a sense that the Japanese people hate the Chinese people?
No. I just had dinner with a Chinese friend tonight over here, and we actually talked about that. There is no general hatred in Japan towards China or the Chinese. For a matter of fact, a lot of plots of land in Kyoto these days are owned by Chinese because Chinese citizens can buy property in Japan, develop it, put Airbnbs on it, use it as a business, rent it out, or use it as a weekend getaway. There is no institutional kind of hatred at all. One thing that Japanese currently are bothered with is over-tourism. But over-tourism across the board, that is not specific towards Chinese. There are right-wing idiots in black cars with ugly flags and so on that are very noisy and that shout despicable stuff about Chinese and about Koreans into the general population. They are a tiny minority and they are hated by everybody because they're so noisy and fear and scary. They do exist, yes, and these people, they are, I couldn't agree with Victor more. They are despicable, but they are a tiny minority, luckily. They are also very noisy, but the general population has no bad blood against China and the Chinese whatsoever.
Let me ask you the same question, Victor. Do you get a sense in China that there is a resentment against Japan? I understand the historics, obviously. The things that happened prior to and during World War II were just completely some of the worst atrocities in the history of the world. I get it. But today, just as a relationship, do the Chinese hate the Japanese still?
Absolutely not. I personally stand for the proposition that between China and Japan and the Chinese people and the Japanese people, we should have friendship for generations to come, for millennia to come. But that proposition has a precondition. That is, Japan will never allow the re-arrival of Japanese fascism mm-hmm. and Japanese neo-militarism. That is the precondition. We do not want to see any military threat from Japan again against China. We do not want to see as what we call Japanese devils, because in the Second World War, between 1931 to 1945, Japanese soldiers killed up to 35 million Chinese people, including soldiers as well as civilians. We never want to suffer that specter again. We want to see Japan forever be committed to peace and to friendship with China and other neighboring countries. And we want to see Japan never scheming another bombing of Pearl Harbor. My suspicion is Prime Minister Takaichi's worst indulgence is to create a military confrontation between China and Japan and push the United States into this war. They want to bind the United States onto the bandwagon of Japan's anti-China policy. I think the Americans are much smarter than that. They will not forget Pearl Harbor. They will not allow the rearmament of Japan. They do not want to see Japan possessing nuclear weapons. So on that note, I think most of the Chinese people and the American people share some identical things about the prospect of Japanese neo-militarism. And on the person-to-person level, on the people-to-people level, I hope the Chinese people and the Japanese people should always respect each other, should always promote peace rather than allow war to be promoted by the neo-Japanese fascism.
What about President Xi? Do you think President Xi, I know you and I talked about him a lot, you've had a lot of experience and you've advised the government in many cases, mostly economic, not about military issues. Nonetheless, do you think these feelings that you're sharing with us, this sense of resentment against what's happening in Japan, is felt by people high up in the government as well?
Absolutely. I think China, Chinese government, the Chinese society, the Chinese people are very clear about our opposition against the rise of Japanese militarism or neo-Japanese fascism. I think there is universal condemnation against what is happening in Japan, and any threat of use of force by Japan against China, which is a violation of the terms of Japan's unconditional surrender to China back in 1945. Now, on top of that, I think the majority of the people here in my country, including my government, support the eternal friendship between China and Japan on the precondition that neo-Japanese fascism, neo-Japanese militarism should never be allowed to happen in Japan.
So what about the government in Japan then, Pascal? Is it something that you think can change or can be moved in a perhaps more peaceful direction with the present prime minister? What does the future look like?
I mean, one thing to also point out is that the current government, actually, after the landslide election that they had 3 weeks ago, actually didn't change very much. The Minister of Defense is still Mr. Koizumi, the son of former Prime Minister Koizumi, who is rather on the left side of this right conservative party. The Conservative Party, the LDP in and of itself, is now the strongest it has ever been, but it is also as pluralistic as it has ever been, because it has to include so many different heads. Also, the previous prime minister, Mr. Ishiba from the left side, is of course still a member of that, not a member of the cabinet, but still a member of the party. I do not see the government of Japan currently drifting towards fascism. What they are doing is militarism, yes. They do want to spend 2% of GDP on the military. They are changing some of the military doctrines, which I think is a bad idea, but I still do hope that just as 10 years ago, they will not manage to actually change the Japanese constitution, which says in Article 9 that it renounces the right to war, and that it will not maintain standing armies, although it has these self-defense forces, which for all intents and purposes are a proper army.
This reminds me of the Germans with Merz, Friedrich Merz, pissing off the Russians and threatening them with war. Like, why would Japan want to piss off China, a country with 1.4 billion people, the largest standing army in the world, soon to be the largest economy in the entire world? why would you want to do that? I mean, why would you go to the biggest, baddest guy and start poking him in the middle of the playground when you can instead find a way to placate him, I guess? I don't know. Is that a too simplistic of a question, Pascal?
No, but, you know, they don't. I do think Japan does not want to poke China in any way. That what happened when Prime Minister Takaichi said what she said, she did so in response to a question by an opposition parliamentarian who tried to push her in exactly the other way. He tried to push her into denying doing that, and she foolishly actually said so. And she used these very, very detrimental words that evoke so many memories, very bad memories in China. I do think that it was also a strategic mistake because no prime minister ever said so. So they kept both ways open. They kept this strategic ambiguity, which she destroyed herself. That is a stupid act, but she cornered herself with that because now if she actually took it back, she would get the wrath of her right-wingers, who she also needs in order to support her government. Although now that's not that true anymore because she has that huge mandate. So I do believe that she has more leeway now to try to fix this situation, although in order not to lose face, she would not be able to do it by standing in front of the cameras and say, like, I officially apologize and bow. But there might be other ways of doing so. And one more thing I want to add is it just shows that in East Asia, words matter. The president of the United States today can say anything under the sun, as outrageous as possible, like I want Greenland and stuff like that. And it doesn't matter because
five
we all know this.
Right.
We are past this. And in East Asia, words matter. So I do hope that she understood that point now.
What would you like her to say, Victor? I mean, I can sense from you, and I've kind of gotten to know you. You have a passion about you where you're actually personally take this as a personal affront, what she said. Like, you're angry about it, and you have every right to be angry about it. What can she say now? What can the Japanese now say as a government, not necessarily to appease you or the Chinese, but just what you think would be the proper response at this point? What would you recommend to them if you were advising?
Well, I think Japan needs to make the promise that they will never change the pacifist constitution, which does not allow the formation of a formal military force or tampering with any idea of possessing and developing and deploying or using nuclear weapons. That's the minimum. And I think that will make sure that Japan is really not down the road of developing Japanese neo-fascism, for example, and it will not try to become another military threat against China. Now, for the wrong things that Prime Minister Takaichi said, the Chinese government demanded that she need to retract that. She need to denounce what she said. I think that is probably more symbolic than substantively. I think the more substantive thing is for Japan to really commit to the pacifist constitution, to renouncing war, to never constitute another military threat against China, and never threaten to use war against China. The other thing, allow me to emphasize, I think for Prime Minister Takaichi to believe that by alienating relations with China, she can develop Japanese economy, well, that is a fantasy. If China-Japanese relations are strained, if China continues to impose massive sanctions against Japan in terms of dual-use materials, including rare earth materials, I think the Japanese economic development will lose steam. And eventually, Prime Minister Takaichi will deny prosperity to the millions of the people in Japan. I think in East Asia, China-Japanese friendship should be the cornerstone of the regional peace and stability, and no one in Japan should be allowed to damage peace and stability between China and Japan and between Japan and other neighboring countries. We need to put a premium on peace rather than seeing politicians agitating for armament, rearmament, militarization, or even re-fascism of Japan. That should never be allowed to happen.
What are the possibilities as we conclude this really fascinating conversation between two guys I so much respect and I think are so smart? Pascal, if you could finish us off with what is the possibility that we might hear from the prime minister or someone in a position of authority in the Japanese government what Victor has just asked or wanted to hear them say? What is the possibility that could happen?
I think the possibility that Prime Minister Takaichi openly says that what Victor just said, you know, that peace and prosperity between China and Japan are necessary for the future of East Asia, that one is very high. And they do not question that. They do want a good relationship with China. Luckily, also, we are in a situation where the Japanese and the Chinese government do have military-to-military exchanges, where the ministries of defense can have a hotline between each other, and they do annual meetings. So all of these confidence-building measures are in place. What I hope is that no other gaffe will come in the way, and that Prime Minister Takaichi, although she will not be able to outrightly say so, be able to convey the message that, you know, this friendship is very, very important. And for instance, if somebody asks her that question again, refuse to answer it, and thereby, you know, send a signal that this question of Taiwan must not come between the peace and prosperity between China and Japan.
But why not just say, we have no sights on China, we have no plans to militarily attack China now or in the future, we are not remilitarizing ourselves in any way, and certainly in no way that should be seen as a threat from us by China? Those are easy words. I just came up with them. Why can't she?
No, I believe she can. And I would have to look it up whether she ever said them or not. That really, the problem is that the issue of the island of Taiwan can be used as a way to blow up the relationship. And again, it was over the issue of mainland Chinese military ships sailing toward Taiwan in that very specific example that everything blew up. So the most important issue is to somehow find a modus vivendi and a solution for the entire region, including the question of the Taiwan Straits. This is essential for future peace.
This has been such a good conversation. You guys are both superstars in your own right. Thank you so much for giving us this perspective on something as important as this. My goodness. Victor, as usual, hope to talk to you again very soon. Maybe I'll see you in Beijing. And
thank you.
And it's always it's always a pleasure, Pascal, talking to you. You're such a smart guy and you do such a great show. Thanks again to both of you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
We thank you. And by the way, we've had so many comments on this show lately. You know, in the last like 24 days, just in social media alone, YouTube and stuff, we've hit like 6 million people have been checking into our stuff, watching us and commenting. We did a show last week on this crazy thing I've seen in Canada and in the United States with transgender shootings, which I thought, wow, what the hell is with that, right? So we debated it here on the show. And we kind of were trying to ask whether the media has pushed this into reality, right? So we had Che Bose here and we had Destiny here and they talked about it. And you guys, so many of you watched this and commented. Here's some of the comments, ready? Sporty Boy says, while my perspective is that of a gay man, in other words, he's saying I am a gay man, there were questions posed and observations by Che with little to none of the degradation I feel when debating a transphobic homophobe. I'll share that comment with Che when I talk to him. NF83 says, the Irish gentleman makes a lot of conclusions, that's Che, but has no arguments to back them up. Dr. Egan Chokolakian says, that Destiny guy seems very smart. Good arguments, I think. Comrade Bullion says, Rick Sanchez, you rock, brother. You have been on a spectacular roll lately. Well, thank you. Keep up the great work. So happy to see you on RT again. You were my favorite anchor on there once upon a time. Why not now? Also, Almira Munir says, Che Bose is a clear-minded, reasonable, and very intelligent professional. Stephen is a product of American gender policy himself. And Matra Boss says, this is what the American system and ideology led to. It all progressed to this. Listen to Hillary's voice. Okay. Well, as usual, we so much appreciate the feedback. Check out our page on YouTube. It's called Journalistically Speaking. You can also find me on X. So many of you have been commenting lately. And BitChute to come. In fact, we're going to be talking about that to you hopefully by the end of the week so that we can be on there. Oh, and Spotify just reached out to us and said, they're excited to start putting our voice on there too. So we're breaking out. Thank you. Thank you so much for letting us into your homes. I'm Rick Sanchez, and we'll be looking for you next time.